The Chinatown apothecary smelled of dried ginseng and something darker, opium, maybe, or just old paper left too long in damp air. Rain drummed on the tin roof above, a steady percussion that made the shelves tremble in their brackets. Pearl stepped over the threshold, and the bell above the door gave a single, tired note. She had been here twice before, always passing through, never stopping. The shop occupied a narrow storefront on Mott Street, wedged between a tea merchant and a tailor who mended shoes. Inside, the space stretched deeper than it should have, lined floor to ceiling with jars and bundles and drawers pulled slightly ajar like mouths that had forgotten how to speak. Wei stood behind the counter, sorting through a pile of dried roots with fingers stained yellow at the tips. He looked up when she entered, his expression neither surprised nor welcoming. He was 60 if he was a day, with a face that had been carved from something harder than flesh-high cheekbones, a mouth that had never smiled in Pearl's experience, eyes the color of weak tea. "You're late," he said. "I haven't told you what I need yet." He set down the root he'd been holding. It rolled across the wooden counter and disappeared into a crack between the planks. "That's why you're late. You waste time deciding what you want before you ask for it. Your father didn't do that." Pearl felt the familiar prickle at the back of her neck, the one that meant he'd reached for something she didn't want him to touch. She kept her hands visible, palms forward, the way you'd approach a dog you didn't trust. "I'm not here to talk about my father." "No," Wei's mouth twitched, which might have been amusement or might have been pain. "You're here about Thomas Erickson." She didn't answer. The rain got louder for a moment, a sudden gust, hitting the tin roof hard enough to make the whole shop shudder and then settled back into its steady rhythm. Wei picked up a different root this time, thinner, darker. He turned it over in his fingers, examining the fibrous surface like it held answers. "He came to me 3 days ago," Wei said. "Before he died, or after, depending on how you measure time, he brought something with him, a small box, wooden, lacquered." "What was inside?" "Something that belongs to my family." His voice didn't change. It stayed flat, polite, the way a man describes a weather event. "Not important. What matters is what I found when I examined the body." Pearl shifted her weight. Her boots were wet from the walk through Chinatown puddles the color of ink, reflecting the gas lamps in shattered pieces. She could feel the .32 in her coat pocket, three rounds counting down, heavier than brass, heavier than gilt. "Examine the body? Wei, you're an apothecary. You don't examine corpses." "I know a man who does." Wei set the root down. "A friend, coroner adjacent, not official. Official coroners take orders from men like Silas Vane." "My friend takes orders from no one." He paused. "Your friend too, perhaps, Coroner Harlan." Pearl's jaw tightened. Harlan had signed off on drowning, accidental. She'd argued against it. Doyle had told her to stop. She'd stopped. But the argument remained lodged in her throat like a fishbone. "The poison," Wei said. "It was in his lungs, not the river. Poison, before he went into the water. He was already dying when they threw him in." The rain hammered harder. Somewhere behind the counter, a jar rattled against another jar, a tiny metallic complaint. Pearl felt the words arrive before she understood what they meant. Thomas Erickson hadn't drowned. He'd been poisoned first, then dumped. The drowning had been theatrics. The murder had been medical. "What poison?" she asked. Wei reached below the counter. Pearl's hand went instinctively to her coat, to the revolver, and caught herself before the movement became violence. She lowered her hand slowly. Wei emerged with a small glass vial, no larger than her thumb, filled with a liquid so clear it might have been water. But the liquid clung to the glass differently, thicker, slower, catching the dim light in a way that made Pearl's stomach turn. "Aconite," Wei said. "Monkshood, fast acting." The victim would have felt his hands go numb, then his heart. Within minutes, he'd stop breathing. They called it Wolf's Bane in the old country. The Chinese call it Chuan Wu. Different names, same result. "How do you know it was in his system?" "Because my friend tasted it." Wei's eyes met hers, and for the first time, something flickered behind them, not fear exactly, something older. On the lining of his stomach, on his tongue, he was dead, but the poison was fresh. Hours, not days. Pearl took the vial from Wei's palm. It was cold. The glass was smooth, hand-blown, generic enough to sit on any apothecary shelf in the city. She could have bought it without asking questions. Silas Vane could buy it with a phone call. Why bring me this? She said. If you already know what it is, why bring me a bottle? Because I need you to understand what comes next. Wei leaned forward. The shadows behind him made his face look hollow, carved out. There is an antidote, or there was, I had it prepared. 3 days ago, when the man came to me with the box, I began to prepare it. But then I realized something. What? That the man who brought me the box was my son. The words landed like stones in still water. Pearl felt the ripples before she understood the shape of the disturbance. Your son? What does your son have to do with? He worked at the mill, with Thomas Erickson. 6 years, same as the victim, same shift, same grievances. Wei's voice remained perfectly level. My son loved my wife. My son fed my children. My son also believed that a man who dies with poison in his stomach and a key sewn into his hem is a man who dies for something. He believed the poison was justice. Did he put it in Erickson's drink? Were you the one who put it in Erickson's drink? My son is not in the city anymore, he said. He left last night. He left because men in gray coats came to our door and asked questions about the box. Questions I could not answer without implicating him. Questions I would not answer even if I could. Pearl's fingers tightened around the vial. So you want me to burn the evidence? I want you to understand that evidence is a luxury. Survival is a necessity. Wei's voice dropped half a degree. The evidence that links my son to this crime exists in your possession, or it will if you continue down the path you've chosen. Consume it, and my son remains hidden. Consume it, and you live to investigate another day. Refuse, and I cannot protect him from what comes next. And the antidote, Pearl said. You're holding the antidote hostage. I am holding a choice in front of you, Wei straightened. There is no antidote, Pearl Casey. There hasn't been one for hours. The poison was administered too late for any remedy. What I prepared was for my son. He took it last night. He took it because he knew what he had done and he knew what would come after. He chose to leave rather than face the men in gray coats. He chose to leave rather than face me. The vial felt heavier in her hand, or maybe her hand was getting colder. She couldn't tell the difference. So you brought me here to tell me that a boy who killed a man took his own life, and that I should destroy the proof, because grief makes poor morality. I brought you here to tell you that the man who killed Thomas Erickson was not your son. Wei's voice sharpened, the first crack in the politeness. Your son administered the poison. He did it in the mill bathroom in the space between 5 and 6 o'clock when the victim had gone to wash his face. He did it because Erickson was going to speak to someone outside the mill, to someone who could expose the sabotage, the grease on the rail joints, the marks on every third column. Your son loved the mill. He loved the work. He believed the sabotage was the only way to make them listen. Pearl's mind raced backward, through the blueprints, through the red X's, through the columns marked for failure. Every third support, greased rail joints. The pattern wasn't random. It was calculated. It was designed to bring the structure down at a specific point, at a specific time, with a specific number of casualties. And Sila's vein, she said, where does he fit? Wei's expression didn't change, but something behind his eyes shifted, a door closing, a decision made. Sila's vein built the railway. Sila's vein profits from its collapse. Sila's vein pays the men who grease the joints and mark the columns and plant the explosives. Your son was a tool, a small tool, easily replaced. I want you to make the choice that keeps my son alive. Wei's voice softened, almost imperceptibly. He placed both palms flat on the counter, as if bracing himself against the edge. Burn the vial. Burn the letter. Walk away and let the men in gray coats find nothing when they tear through your apartment. Please, I am not asking you to look away. I am asking you to look away because if you don't, there will be a dead boy and a dead detective, and no one either of us cares about will be any closer to justice. You want me to burn the evidence, she said again, and you want me to believe that Vane is the real target. Wei's voice softened, almost imperceptibly. Choose what keeps my son alive. He looked away. Understand that the truth is sometimes a stone you carry until it breaks your feet. Sometimes you set it down. Pearl looked at the vial, looked at Wei, looked at the jars and bundles and drawers behind him, each one holding something preserved, something saved, something waiting to be used. She thought of Thomas Erickson's body in the morgue on Draper Street, his trousers stitched shut, the key sewn into the hem like a confession he'd never written. She thought of the blueprints in her coat, the red X's marking columns that would fail, the grease on the joints that would turn a commute into a catastrophe. She thought of her father, of the trick he'd taught her, of the way she'd carried it for 29 years like a weapon and never understood that it was a burden. "How do I know you're telling the truth?" she said. Wei reached below the counter again. This time he produced a folded piece of paper, yellowed at the edges, creased so many times it was nearly torn. He laid it on the counter between them. Pearl unfolded it carefully. It was a letter, written in Chinese characters she couldn't read, but beneath it was a translation in English neat, precise handwriting, the kind you'd see on a business card or a formal invitation. "My son," the letter read, "if you are reading this, you have already made your choice. I do not blame you. I only ask that you remember your mother's name when you close your eyes. Her name was Lin." Pearl folded the letter and put it in her coat pocket, next to the vial, next to the .32. Three things that weighed more than they should. Three things she couldn't uncarry. "When did he take it?" she asked. "Last night, around midnight." Wei's eyes drifted to the curtain again, to the shadow that hadn't moved. "He left a note, short. He said he was sorry. He said he loved us. He said the mill was more important than he was." Pearl nodded once. She didn't trust her voice. She turned toward the door, her boots heavy on the wooden floor, the bell above giving another tired note as she pushed through into the rain. Behind her, Wei spoke one more time, quiet enough that she almost didn't hear it over the drumming on the tin roof. "Burn the evidence, Pearl Casey. Save the boy or save the truth. But choose quickly." The rain hit her face like a slap, washing the grime from her skin as she stepped onto Pell Street. Gas lamps flickered in the wet air, casting long shadows against the gray indifference of the city. Pearl checked the solid weight of the vial in her pocket, then turned south toward Broome Street and the station house, the only path left open.